Hey, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, your co-host, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans. I'll let my colleague introduce himself.
Yeah, Will Gatsby-Pete, the other co-host and co-founder here, and very excited for this one as an ardent e-bike rider. So yeah, great pod for you today.
Yeah, I thought about this. I was on a Lime bike the other day, and it was an arduous trip in the rain here in London. But to the point of the podcast, though, we are joined by Robin Erickson, CEO and co-founder of Coco. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much, guys. Great to be here.
And you're calling in from Copenhagen, you said, yeah?
Correct, yeah. Great. The bike capital of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. Well, good stuff. Well, first things first, want to ask our guests, as we do the top of every show, to like and share, subscribe, and to rate our podcast. That'll keep us going and help us bring on more great guests like Robin. So please get on that.
The more likes and subscribes, the better the podcast gets. So yeah, do it. That's your guilt trip.
I was on Spotify the other day and I was like, maybe I should rate my own podcast. That probably makes sense. And I did it. How many stars do you think I gave it?
Five, I hope.
I gave it five stars.
Please rate it and rate it well.
I'm probably the first one that rated my app as well. So
there you go. Company Slack channel, you're like, guys, everyone, five stars, come on.
Please.
I need this.
Friends, family.
Yeah, start with friends and family. Well, first things first, Robin, give our audience a little intro. Like, who are you? And tell us about Coco and sort of a high-level synopsis there.
Yeah, for sure. I'm Robin Erickson. I'm Swedish originally, but I've been living in Denmark now for the last 7 or 8 years. And I launched Coco now about 2 years ago, which is essentially an app that gathers all the shared scooters, bikes, cars, and mopeds around the world. So we so far gathered a bit over 250 different mobility operators. You can use us in 700 cities worldwide. And we really want to help you make an easier choice to kind of park your car at home, grab a shared bike or scooter or an electric car and so on. And just trying to help improve the world's cities.
Amazing. And what was, I guess, the inspiration for you specifically to start Coco?
Yeah, so a bit more of a background. I used to work for one of the biggest travel sites in the world, Momondo. It was later acquired by Kayak. So we essentially gathered flights and hotels, rental cars and so on into one simple platform. And after my time there, I joined another mobility startup in Sweden. And eventually I started seeing this new phenomena with electric scooters popping up in the US. Eventually it came here to Europe as well. And I really saw how popular it became. And then all of a sudden, there felt like there was thousands of operators around, you know, different brands, but the same kind of form factor. And at that time, I was living in Copenhagen. I was working in Sweden, and I was using these kind of modes to get around in a couple of cities. And I had so many different apps to get around. So I was like, okay, there should be an aggregator for this. Obviously, I'm coming from Momondo and Kayak. And realized that maybe there wasn't a platform that really fulfilled my needs. So felt that I could really make a difference with the background that I had. So yeah, started working on it, and now I'm here and talking
well
to you guys.
Nice. Well, let's jump to the news. One of the first pieces we share with you is from Bloomberg, and it talks about like the need across the board for e-bikes. I thought one of the most fascinating pieces about this article was it talking about, you know, e-bikes taking over some aspects of transport. Maybe if it's rainy or muggy or something like that, someone might use an e-bike instead of not going at all or using some other mode of transportation, but also opening up transport options for folks like maybe who are older or they have, you know, mobility issues and things like that. So super curious to hear your perspective, given what you do, about this piece and just about that trend in e-bikes opening up transportation options for folks.
Yeah. I mean, we're not dealing with private e-bikes per se, but if you want to share it, then you can find it on our platform. But yeah, in general, I would say it's an amazing product. I mean, a car, you know, usually weighs around 2 tons, and the average person weighs 70-80 kilos. The ratio to that the weight of the car is actually mainly transporting itself around, right? Not the person. So, and we see it a lot here in Copenhagen. Like, e-bikes are so popular. We have these Christiania bikes. We have a big kind of big trunk in the front for the bike where you can have your kid or your bags or your dogs or your whatever. You can fit like 2-3 people in the front, right? And it's just so much more efficient to get around. So we see that a lot in Copenhagen. But I think it's a really great alternative to private car ownership in itself. It's cheaper than a car, of course. They're still pretty pricey, but it's cheaper. You only need to charge it, you know, so it's also cheaper to get around with. So I think it's an amazing form factor for a transport vehicle, especially in the cities.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting points in that article was kind of agreeing with everything you said, and I do as well, and saying that despite all that, lawmakers aren't quite realizing the potential yet. And there's a lot of people pushing like, hey, you should get an e-car, you should get a Tesla or something, you know, and there's lots of tax credits in there, lots of support for bike lanes and cyclists and things like that. But the e-bike hasn't quite captured the imagination of the sort of climate change movement or the legislators who are putting tax credits in place for other things, but not for e-bikes. So yeah, we're just super kind of interested in your perspective. Like, what do you think is going on there? In particular, why hasn't the sort of sustainability movement championed e-bikes as much as you might expect, given I think it's pretty undeniable they do take car usage down and are a more eco-friendly form of transport?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's the problem with policy and all the politicians and so on. It's always lagging. I think they're trying to put a Band-Aid on something instead of properly fixing it.
Yeah.
So you're right, yeah. There's also here in Denmark now, they're building tons of new roads and so on, just to help more people driving into Copenhagen and so on from other parts of the cities, instead of building better train tracks or public transport lines and so on. It is a shame, because it can really fix a lot of the issues if we look at the environmental aspects. Like, I think it's 1/5 of all emissions globally every year comes from transport. And obviously a lot of the transport happens in the cities with cars and also buses and taxis and so on, and bikes, except for walking. Biking is the most eco-friendly option out there.
Problem with a lot of politics is you need very short-term, very loud solutions to quiet problems. And, you know, it's when we have the world held to ransom by, you know, fossil fuel dictators, the US's response to that is to try and cut a deal with the Saudis who, you know, in a short term, rather than thinking more, because that's what people at the pump want to see, their fuel prices go down in a week, not in 5 years' time. And so, you know, you have all these resources and politics put into short-term solutions, rather than maybe we should just build better trains and bike roads, but it's going to be the administration in 10 years' time that gets the kudos and the karma from that. Like, it's not going to be us. And so they're just, you know, as always with politics, the incentive structures are not aligned. You know, it's just a sad state of the world that people only do stuff they get credit for and helps them win votes.
Great segue to the next piece, which super interested to hear your take on this, Robin. It's titled E-Bike is a Monstrosity over at The Atlantic, and we wanted to throw a little spicy one at you to see what your reaction would be. But I thought one of the more interesting things in this piece was talking about a couple of things, like the health benefits of an e-bike as relate to a traditional bike, the cost of an e-bike, and the e-bike as a status symbol. I thought that was really fascinating as it relates to, you know, buying expensive traditional bike or buying expensive car as a status symbol. Super curious to hear your perspective on those three factors specifically, kind of health, cost, and sort of e-bike as a status symbol as it relates to how people are thinking about e-bikes.
Yeah, okay. So if we start with the health aspect, I mean, obviously a manual bike is better than an e-bike because you need to work a bit harder. And I know there's a lot of research around that as well, like how biking compared to taking your car benefits you, not only like how the heart pumps and the lung capacity and so on, but it also, you know, it strengthens your core to some extent and it helps you sleep. There's like a tremendous positive aspects on that side, because you're more active. It's like, it's better to walk the stairs than taking the elevator. I bike every day, but I'm also in Copenhagen, so it's weird to take the car almost. Like you can't really take the car at all. Like, it doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah, that piece was sort of talking about, and you know, I thought it was a bit of a, having been a journalist in a previous life, I thought it was very much a piece that's just like, oh God, I've just got to thrash something out. It didn't feel the most well-researched, and it kind of just sounded like someone having a bit of a bitch and a moan about the fact that they'd bought an e-bike and didn't immediately love it. Mm-hmm. In the piece, they talk about how the e-bike is a bit of a hybrid of lots of different things. You know, it's halfway between a bike and a moped, and how in some ways that's useful, but in others it's almost a bit of a drawback, because you're like, it feels weird and you're not not sure when to use it, when not to use it. So yeah, just interesting. Like one of the particular points in it that I thought was super interesting was they're saying this does seem to be something that's reflected in kind of the VC market in terms of, you know, Bird was at some point valued at a couple of billion and is now down to sort of 120 mil. What more from the market perspective, have you been seeing anything there? You know, do you feel like actually maybe people just jumped the shark a bit and they overvalued stuff at the beginning and there's been a slow but steady increase in e-bike and scooter usage and it's definitely an emerging and growing market. It's just growing steadily rather than rapidly. Or is there anything you're seeing there in terms of like maybe it's plateaued? What are kind of the barriers to entry for people using e-scooters and e-bikes much more as part of their day-to-day?
Yeah, the valuation was like the last couple of years. It's not only in this industry, in all industries essentially. And you're really seeing now that investors are pulling back on the valuations and they're increasing the requirements a lot on startups. I mean, our industry, when it comes to the e-scooters and so on, the big popularity started in 17. So that's 5 years ago. So it's a very, very young industry. Mm. So I think, in my opinion, I mean, I don't have all the information, but I think it was a bit premature for some of the operators to go public. I can understand why some of them were forced to do it, but it's not there. Like, it's still a lot on the operational excellence, the profitability, the margins and so on, which needs to be proven, I think. And that's also what we want to help out with Kogo is to, you know, get more people to use it, essentially help improving the margins by, you know, essentially we're aggregators are an acquisition channel for the players that are actually operating the fleet. And we're beating all the other traditional marketing platforms because the relevance is so high.
Mm-hmm. One thing I will say is like I use e-bikes and e-scooters a lot. And the reason that I do above all else is just the absolute ease of finding one. You know, obviously I'm in London, it's a very saturated market. There's always like an e-bike or a scooter around the corner. So this isn't applicable to everyone. But getting a cab now is a nightmare. It takes like 15 minutes if it shows up. It's quite expensive. Getting the underground is fine. You know, I love the London Underground. But for those shorter journeys or even those journeys where it's a nice day and I just want to enjoy myself, there is probably no quicker, more enjoyable way for me to get an e-bike or a scooter. So I do think maybe it's more just a case of it's going to take 3 or 4 years to change people's behaviors. But once you do get converted, like me and Paul have been, you don't really go back. Like, you know, I, especially in summer, use an e-bike for half of my journeys rather than the underground. So yeah, it's maybe just a slow boil, but people get there eventually.
I thought about that. And I feel like that was like a subtext, a lot of these articles, and Robin, I'd be curious to hear your perspective about this, but like behavior change and getting e-bikes like fit into people's, because when I took this trip the other day with Lime, you know, I had left the house. I'm like, oh shit, I'm going to be late for the gym. I already know, because if I have to walk, it's a half hour walk. I purposely didn't want to take my traditional bike because I can't take it on the train later on if I want to go somewhere else. And then I found that like the Lime and the e-bike was an afterthought. I like literally ran into a Lime bike on the street and was like, oh, I should totally take this. I can just drop it off and leave it. Why didn't I think of this before? And it just got me thinking, like, how do we integrate this more into people's behavior than e-bike is an option? Is it, you know, having depots where it's like very clear near where they live that they're there? Is it Google telling you, oh, you're trying to take this trip, here's a better option, which I've seen a little bit with Google Maps integrating it. But yeah, curious about how y'all think about that.
Totally right. It is a behavioral change. Like I said, it's only 5 years old. Mm. Like shared bikes and so on, it started in the 60s in Amsterdam, actually. So it is super old. But the popularity and actually the possibilities with the technology we have now with the smartphones has enabled it to really become popular. And like you said, you know, being out in the open air and not being maybe on a crowded tube or a bus and so on. I mean, during the pandemic that people actually started taking bikes and scooters for health reasons or health concerns. So they actually revised their 10-year projection for the market and so on, because they believe that people would actually start using it more and so on. So there are different reasons to why people want to use it. But it is, like you say, it's not top of mind yet. Like we've had cars for hundreds of years. We have had buses and all of that for so long. This is so new. And that takes time. You also see it in regulations and so on. It kind of started as a, like in Sweden, where I'm from, there was no classification for it. So they actually couldn't do anything about the kind of a bit chaos that happened in a few cities, because then they would actually regulate normal bikes. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't start regulating normal bikes the way you wanted to regulate e-scooters. So again, like it's just that I think policymakers just needed to kind of catch up, see what happened. And now we can see that more and more cities are rolling out the kind of same similar regulations in terms of speed limits. So it's usually below 20 kilometers per hour, where you're allowed to park. There's slow zones. It's just stuff like that needs to kind of catch up a bit. Then I think people will realize the benefits, both financially, but also the time it takes for you to travel, the ease of it. I mean, it is also fun. Like if it's a sunny day, it's super nice to be out on the streets and not go down in the metro. So I think we need to get used to it. It takes time. And then I think that's a lot that also why we started working on Kogo was that we wanted to, if you're going to incentivize or make people change, it needs to be to a better option. It needs to be convenient. It needs to be easy. Like if you have a car parked outside of your door in your house, you can't really get more convenient than that and just getting out, getting into the car. What we want to help people to do is to really with the convenience factor that, okay, there is a scooter or bike parked there. It's 50 meters away from where you have your car, but it's right there. You can then also park it right next to it because there are designated parking spots where you need to go. And you can just leave it there. You don't have to worry about getting stolen or damaged or anything because it's not yours. It's the company's, right? And then it needs to be price worthy as well. So really help with the price levels as well. So it's if it's too expensive, you're not going to afford it. So that's kind of what we're bringing in, the transparency and helping to empower people to find the best option. Because then we can actually get people to use these kind of new modes of transport that are just getting started.
Yeah, I spoke to a chap from SAE International a year ago who, you know, they commissioned multi-million pound studies into this sort of thing of like, what's the future of urban mobility? And he was like, personal delivery drones and e-scooters and e-bikes, that's going to be the future of the next 5 years in terms of urban transport. So just get on board with it now. And yeah, I think from the price point as well, it feels much more sustainable. Like we were talking on another pod about Uber and how Uber was like, hey, it lied to you about how much a cab cost for 7 years. And recently over the last year or two, the price point has got closer to what a cab actually should be because they've stopped essentially subsidizing your ride. And you always make sense when you figure it out in your head. It's like this driver that's driving me around has just got paid 20 quid an hour. That's not a great wage for what he's doing. Whereas the scooters and the bikes and stuff, it feels like the economic, okay, well, I just paid 8 quid for a bike ride and 20 other people are going to do that today. So that company just made £160. They'll pay off the bike in 6 months and then they're into pure profit. Like it just feels like a genuine business model that works and will be around for a lot longer rather than, you know, having the rug pulled out of you with Uber.
You know, sort of incentivizing investors to like understand that, because like, even the Uber cost doesn't factor in the environmental detriment that
getting
it takes
from ethics. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
I think it was way back. I heard that it actually increased the number of cars in San Francisco or something like that, because there was so many Uber riders around just waiting to get rides. So it was actually more people coming into the city. So again, I mean, it's great that we move over to electric vehicles, of course, electric cars. But it's still cars.
Still cars, yeah.
And we're so far off the environmental goals and all of that. So, I mean, the 1.5 and so on. So it's like we need to do so much more. And we should just use a vehicle that is made for the purpose of the trip. And that is, in your mind, it's like, I always need a car. But you don't need a car to take your gym bag to go to the gym. Like, it's you in a bag. If you're picking up your kid, we talked about the e-bikes with the big cargo, like you can fit your kid in front and it's so nice. Like it's fun. You know, you see dogs hanging out, you know, and they're super happy with the tongue out. And I mean, you see it all the time. And one of your questions from before was actually about kind of the status and so on. And I mean, it is like when you see one on the street, it looks cool.
Yeah,
like it looks super cool.
It strikes me that one of the key issues in sort of when we're talking about e-bikes and such is infrastructure. So you shared this piece from The Guardian about cities getting an award from, I think it was Bloomberg Charities, $1 million to build bike lanes. And I thought one of the fascinating things about this piece was all the data that they got from what the battles that are happening in New York City. And just this idea that bike lane infrastructure is what we think of today, but looking back to what bridges and tunnels were in the 20th century. So super curious to hear your opinion about how, you know, we need to move things forward with infrastructure. And then also as that relates to behavior change as well, because it struck me the other day that if there was like a bike depot right outside my place that I could think, okay, I can hop on an e-bike here, that would have changed my whole sort of behavior and treatment of e-bikes. So yeah, what are your thoughts on infrastructure for them?
I mean, 100%. I mean, you need the proper bike lanes if you want to have more people biking. And the reason why it's so popular here in Copenhagen, I mentioned Amsterdam, because they started with this already, I think, in the 70s. You know, so they've been really developing the city around bicycles. And it's not just that it's a thin little bike lane. I mean, here we have bike lanes that are like 3 meters wide. Sometimes there's more space on certain streets, there's more space for bikes than for cars, and so on. And it all comes down to safety. Like, do the people on the bike feel safe? Then they will use it. If they don't, like if you're mixed in with traffic and so on, even though you're not gonna get hit, it's scary to be next to cars. So to really get this moving, you need proper bike lanes and the infrastructure for it. Of course, that ties into also e-scooters and so on. So it's super, super important. So closing down the car lanes, give one car lane to bicycles, and you will just see the impact immediately.
Mm. You really feel that in a city like London, I feel like, because there just really aren't that many lanes. And like, it feels like you have to go against the grain, at least here in London, even if the weather is good, even if the, you know, bikes are openly available, to have that, you know, integrated into your lifestyle.
And when you do find it, occasionally there are like one or two roads with really lovely bike lanes. Yeah. Like, oh my God, how much nicer is this? Yeah. Like, to your point, Robin, how much safer do I feel? You know, this is a way nicer experience rather than an A road where it's just like, oh, I'll just tuck in onto the bus lane and I know no one's going to hit me. But there is always that little thing in the back of your head, just like, this is a little sketchy.
And it also needs to be, you know, convenient. We have these green lanes, but like one of my co-founders, Bibi, she's biking into the office sometimes. We're in the middle of the city, but she lives outside in the suburbs. And she gets on her road bike and then bikes for an hour, and then there's this kind of green lane. So if you keep a certain speed, you'll always hit a green light. So you'll never get a red light. So you can just keep going. And they measure that a lot, like how when they've changed the way they kind of structure the traffic lights and so on, how just by adjusting it a bit, you just see that the bike traffic just flows.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you're, you know, in the morning hours or in the afternoon, the evening rush and so on, there's such a big difference on the time it takes to go through the city.
Mm.
Like, it takes me 10 minutes to get to work or get home. In rush hour, it could take me half an hour with a car.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's the same way. Like, I don't take another route. Mm-hmm. It's just because I'm stuck in traffic.
Yeah, I'm constantly taken aback by how many problems in our society are like design problems. It's just, you know, the way things are structured and shaped, and some of them arguably purposeful, but just like that's a design flaw. You know, the way that bike lane has been made, or the way that access to a certain public infrastructure, it's just like, come on, guys, like this is solvable. So want to jump into a few more questions about Kogo to share with our audience. And we've already asked you previously about the origin story and how you got started, but we'd love to hear about any success stories you've had with Kogo so far. Any favorites? I know you're not supposed to pick, you know, your favorite child, but what are some of your favorite success stories from your time at Kogo?
There's always the ups and downs, right? We can talk a whole podcast about all the struggles, but it's more fun to listen to the success stories maybe.
Yeah.
But it's been an interesting journey, right? We're a mobility startup, essentially, you know, wanting to get people to move in the cities and travel and experience places. And we launched in March of 2020. That was the week after Denmark went into a lockdown. So like, no one was moving around and the world stopped, right? So we started in a bit of a uphill battle. Yeah, so me and my co-founders, you know, we all come from Amondo. That's where we met. We managed to attract very talented people as well, suited for the task. So we're still a small team with 10 people, but it's very diverse. We're 40% women if we exclude the tech team. I'm the only guy in the team, so then we're 80% female, and from 6 different nationalities, I believe. So I mean, we have a really diverse team. So I think we're very fortunate that we managed to bring in very skilled and diverse people. We've had over a million users so far, with very limited marketing spend in over 100 countries easily. We had one couple of sessions on Antarctica once. I don't think we found many bike scooters there, but wow. We saw there was a person opening the app there. So that was pretty fun. And we managed to build a very great product. I mentioned it in the beginning, but we have 250 mobility operators. That's more than any platform in the world that I know of. We have huge database of the different prices or the pricing fees and the structures. It's very different. So you can actually compare all of the operators, all of the vehicle types in one simple search. So it was about the transparency and being empowered as a user. You can really go in and see who is the cheapest, what will take me from A to B the fastest, who is closest, or what's a combination of this. So I think it's very simple when you see it as a user, but it's so complex in the background on how to model all of this. I'm very proud of that. And I think that it helped us to win a few awards as well. So they're starting to call us an award winners now, where we won like the best newcomer in the Nordics at the Nordic Startup Awards. So now we're part of the Global Startup Awards. It's like the Oscars for entrepreneurship. Nice. That week. I was in Oslo at an event there, and we won startup, the most innovative startup in the Nordics, focused on sustainable solutions. So that was also amazing from clean tech. It's nice to get the recognition sometimes because you're a bit focused, you know, evenings, weekends with the team, you're just on your laptop solving problems. So it's nice to get those recognitions from time to time.
That's some great early success.
And then I think the greatest achievement is to see that people actually enjoy using the product and it's helping them. And they're not only using it once, but they're coming back over and over. I think that's very rewarding.
Speaking to that product, like, what do you think are your favorite features that are driving that return for Kogo as a product? What are you most sort of proud of feature-wise?
I mean, what's live today is, I would say, it is the, of course, the overview and everything, so you can compare it, right? But really the price comparison tool, or the comparison tool where you can compare all the prices, the travel time, the proximity to the vehicles, and so on, because it is not something that existed before in our industry. So really helping users to make smarter choices. Soon we're also launching payments, and that is going to be a big game changer for us, of course, because then you can actually start handling the whole journey in our platform. So bringing the same value to the users and the operators, but to a new level. So just helping people to actually getting access to all of these 250 operators, but you don't need 250 apps. That will bring a fundamental value, and I'm very excited about that when we're launching that.
That's great. Super curious to hear a bit more about your personal journey. And you mentioned working at a few places before, you know, starting Kogo, but curious, like, what was the X factor, like the special sauce that you were bringing to Kogo that really helped, you know, accelerate the company's growth and helped you serve as an asset to the team?
Yeah. So, I mean, it is easy to look back and then kind of see all the steps you've taken to land where you are today. And I'm starting to see that pattern. Like, I started at Momond, or actually before that, I had a few projects or startups in Sweden. They were pretty small, but we still had an impact. Then I joined Momondo, which is now one of Europe's largest travel sites. So picked up a lot on the marketing skill. So I have this marketing background combined with a bit of entrepreneurial experience from before. And like I said, when I saw these scooters popping up left and right in Europe, I wanted to get in there somehow, but I couldn't really figure out how. Like, should I start another scooter company, or should we take the car, EV car startup that we had? Should we start making e-bikes or e-scooters and so on? But that wouldn't really make a difference. But then, and that's when I realized, I feel like I'm actually the right guy for the job, because not many have that combination of background. So, but I'm the marketing guy, I'm the entrepreneur guy, I'm not the salesperson, I'm not the tech guy, and so on. So obviously I couldn't do this by myself. So very early on, Bibi heard about the idea through some mutual friends, and then she jumped on the idea. And then we finally managed to convince Martin to join the team as well a bit later. He is like, we're calling him a wizard sometimes, but he hates that word, but he's never said no. There's nothing he can't do. So it's amazing to have him on the team, and the thing him and his team is pulling off is incredible.
Helps have good co-founders. We've definitely learned that.
Yeah.
It's part of this journey. So
I think that's nice with small startups as well. Like, everybody contributes, and if one person is missing, you can really feel it. If you're 1,000 people, like, there's a few that runs through the crack and they don't really contribute. But in this phase, everybody's role is so important for the success of the company. So super excited.
Fair play to the people that start a company on their own. But I couldn't imagine anything worse. It's way nicer to have co-founders to share the journey with and just, you know, lean on. I think you have to be a bit mad to do it all on your own. Like sometimes in a good way, but yeah, not for me.
Yeah. One thing I remember appreciating about switching from previous roles in like nonprofits and education into tech and like the marketing space at least was like, it's a lot harder to hide. Like if you don't show up and do your work, it's very difficult. Whereas I think in other professions, you can kind of like squeak by, and especially the profession I was in, you know, it's like a little bit amorphous. Like is the child learning? Like that's harder to pin down precisely. I mean, you know, it's increasingly getting better in terms of measurement, but I'm just really grateful to work in a space where you're expected to show up and deliver and work with your teammates in a very collaborative way. So it's, yeah, appreciate that. I want to transition us into the lightning round here, where we talk about just kind of like a couple short form questions and quick answers on like about you and what makes you you. So first question we like to ask, this is a tech podcast, obviously you work in tech. What's been one game changing piece of tech for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think there's one, but I'm pretty simple like that. I mean, the product we're making is pretty advanced, of course. But I mean, what I'm using on a day to day is basically my calendar.
Hey, that's a big one.
Otherwise, I forget stuff. I need to have things in order, right? So I'm using a lot of those tools like Trello and so on, Slack for communication with the team. Like I can walk to the toilet, you know, and sending a Slack message to one of my team members, like, remember this and stuff, you know. So it's really about that. So I'm pretty simple like that. I'm sure there's a lot of other good ideas, but one of my strengths is I'm very organized and I get shit done. So my calendar and my Google Drive and all my notes helps me with that.
That's a huge one. We were saying on a previous podcast, like how much credit you can get and like traction you can get by just showing up and doing what you said you're going to do when you said you're going to do it. So
yeah,
appreciate that one. Yeah.
Moving on to the flip side of that, what's one problem you think tech can't solve for us and why?
Technology can solve most of the things, I think, but it won't be able to solve it without us changing. So obviously tying it into what we want to do and why Cowboys is of course to improve the world cities, improve the world, improve the environment and so on. So I think when it comes to the climate crisis, I mean, we have all of the tools available. You know, we have solar panels, we have wind farms, we have electric cars, we have electric bikes and all of that. And that will help, but it will never help us alone. We can't just produce that and then we don't do anything. So it's really about changing our mindsets, and so I think that's a thing that is crucial, that without us changing ourselves, we can't solve the climate crisis.
Yeah. Well said. Favorite question, tech for bad, what's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
So that's a good one. I think maybe not. Yeah. The first that comes to mind is like war droids. Like if back in the days, like the Conqueror One, who had the most soldiers essentially. I mean, it feels like potentially it could be just an army of droids, like in Star Wars. That's a bit scary though. It is being developed like for good, but if there's one thing we should have learned is that if there's only one person that wants to use it for evil, it can have a very devastating impact on the whole world. Just look at Russia and Ukraine now, right? So, I mean, that's a bit scary, and it also gets cheaper. So you don't need to be a big superpower to actually get hold of it. And yeah, that could fuck shit up.
Yeah.
So that's a bit scary. I hope it doesn't happen, but what about you? You must have thought about it as well.
Yeah, military tech, I think, is awful. I think tech around borders, I find to be very, walls, you know, but like you're talking about e-walls and tracking technology and stuff like that. I mean, that broader conversation about borders and migration and stuff like that. But yeah, I think it's really, really problematic.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Like you said, there's so many tech products that people create with the best of intentions, and then 10 years later you're like, oh shit, what have we done? We've completely changed the way that humans interact with each other for the worse. Everyone's far angrier and facts don't matter anymore. Yeah, oopsie. Moving us hopefully on to slightly sunnier climes. If you could dream up a new tech product, what would it be and what problem would it solve? Obviously, other than Kogo, which is a brilliant.
I mean, I just did another one a couple of years ago, right? So, I mean, and I'm doing it, but
has anything come up in the development of Kogo of like, hey, if people just had this other product or something like that, this would enrich their life? I mean, you mentioned like integration and payments and stuff like that, but any other product that you've dreamt up in the process of working on Kogo?
Yeah, there's a lot, and we'll see what we launch.
Yeah,
the super cool thing, what I think would be cool in a way, would be teleportation. Because, I mean, I'm from Sweden, and it would be pretty nice to teleport myself home for Sunday dinners and then head back to Copenhagen.
I've not had teleportation before. I like that. Yeah, that's a great answer.
Yeah, you're talking to a major Star Trek nerd over here. So the transporter, it's just, yeah. It does make me nervous, the idea of like all my atoms and cells being like deconstructed and deconstructed. Like I don't want an ear where my mouth is or anything like that. I like the way things are currently structured. Probably wouldn't need e-bikes anymore if we had that though. Just flagging that.
That's the thing. And I mean, we love doing road trips, me and my girlfriend, when we're out traveling. Okay. So it's about the journey often, but it would also help, you know, no transport, hopefully no emissions. That would be good.
Yeah, fair. We'd like to ask about predictions just to kind of wrap up here. So any predictions you have for the space that you're working in or for tech more broadly for the next year, what's 2023 going to bring?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see a bit of a reset in the market. We touched upon it before, you know, it's been super high valuation, a lot of hype, a lot of new unicorns, a lot of unicorns crashing and so on. And so I think that will trickle down in the whole kind of ecosystem. So it's not only about our industry, but the whole tech industry, obviously. But I think that's good. You need to rethink a bit and really think about what's important. What's my reason to kind of live or exist as a company? Are we focusing on the right thing, like trim off the fat? So I think we'll see a lot of that. And a lot of big companies have been founded in times of crisis. I hope we're one of them. So let's see. And if you come out on the other side, you're usually in a much stronger position. So. I think we'll see a bit of a cleanup. Companies will for sure go bust. You see valuations slashing and so on. Even good ones, I'm sure, we might go bankrupt, right? But that's unfortunately the game we're in. I think 90% of startups fail or whatever it is, but we still do it. So we just have to get slapped in the face and keep going and enjoy the ride. And
love it. Last question. Kogo is obviously a for-profit business, but there's a very much a sort of ethical and aim and kind of heart and soul to the company. Yeah. For you personally, you know, what's worked in terms of building a career in tech that balances profit and purpose simultaneously?
In general, purpose trumps money always in the long run. If you're working for something or someone that you believe in, you will put your heart and soul into it. And if the next person doesn't do that, you will work 10 times harder and that will be rewarded. So I've kind of always followed what I find fascinating. That could be a fascinating tech, or it could be a cool new industry, or it could be a really meaningful purpose. Now we're working on getting people off private cars into shared electric vehicles, improving the cities. I think that's super exciting and required. But we're also working with a lot of cool tech. I mean, we're building stuff here that no one has built before to a long extent. So that could also drive a lot of purpose for many people. So it's follow your passion and what you really are excited about, and then everything else will follow. If you don't, you're probably going to look back and regret a few decisions, but you will never regret doing what you really love. It's so true.
Appreciate that. Well, Robin, you've been really generous with your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a fantastic conversation, and one we've not had before. It's about, you know, the great work that you're doing at Kogo, driving folks towards shared electric cars and bikes and mopeds, and getting everyone just a little bit more thoughtful about how they're traversing their cities and their towns in a way that's a bit more beneficial to the environment. So Robin Erickson, CEO and co-founder of Kogo, really appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining the pod.
Thank you so much. Been a pleasure. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Yep. And real quick, where can folks find you and more about Kogo on the internet?
We're on most of the social media platforms, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. Our website is kogoapp.io. So we try to be open and so you can follow along on our journey. So feel free to reach out. And if you have questions, write on LinkedIn and I'll get back to you.
Great. Well, this has been another episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. As always, please like, share, subscribe, rate our podcast like I did for the other day for the first time. And yeah, we'll be able to bring more great guests like Robin on. So Robin, thanks again for your time and have a good one.
Thank you.